Welcome to our weekly podcast for American English learners and their teachers. Each podcast we share includes activities to help increase fluency in American English comprehension and communication. We are happy you joined us today. Let's begin. Hello, everyone. Greetings from Johan Elvis Searcy, also known as Maestro Searcy, an American English teacher based in Southern California, United States of America. He's been educating English learners since 1989 and currently teaches English as a second language for three different community colleges in Southern California. He was born and raised in Romania, and English became his third language when he moved to the United States of America more than 41 years ago. Thanks to his helpful English as a second language teachers who taught and motivated him to succeed, he was inspired to become an American English teacher and help English learners increase American English fluency. In his spare time, he is also a published author, webmaster, podcaster, YouTube creator, and music producer. In this podcast episode, we will share materials and activities to help you improve your American English comprehension and communication skills. Are you ready? Let's begin.
In today's episode, we will learn about American English grammar with the lesson, Understanding Infinitives and Gerunds. You can find this and other educational lessons via Maestro Searcy's website at www.searcy.com. Are you ready? Let's begin. Understanding infinitives and gerunds. What are infinitives? Infinitives are special forms of verbs. They usually start with to followed by the base form of the verb. For example, to run, to jump, and to eat are all infinitives. Infinitives can be used in different ways in a sentence. As a subject. Example, to play soccer is fun. As an object. Example, I like to read. To show purpose. Example, I went to the store to buy milk. Why use infinitives? Infinitives can make your sentences more interesting and can help you express different ideas. They can describe actions that you want to do or enjoy doing. What are gerunds? Gerunds are verbs that end with ing. They act like nouns in a sentence. For example, running, jumping, and eating are all gerunds. Just like infinitives, gerunds can be used in various ways. As a subject. Example, swimming is my favorite sport. As an object. Example, she enjoys reading. After prepositions. Example, I am good at drawing. Why use gerunds? Gerunds are useful because they can help you describe activities or actions in a way that sounds natural. They help you talk about things you like or dislike doing. Infinitives versus gerunds. Infinitives and gerunds can sometimes be used in similar ways, but they are not always interchangeable. Here are some examples. Infinitive, I want to swim. Gerund, I enjoy swimming. In the first sentence, to swim tells us what the person wants to do. In the second sentence, swimming shows what the person enjoys. When to use infinitives and gerunds. Some verbs are followed by infinitives, while others are followed by gerunds. Here are some examples of each. Verbs followed by infinitives. Want, I want to dance. Decide, she decided to go to the party. Hope, we hope to win the game. Verbs followed by gerunds. Enjoy, he enjoys playing basketball. Avoid, they avoid eating junk food. Finish, I finished writing my homework. Mixed verbs. Some verbs can be followed by either infinitives or gerunds, but the meaning may change. Start. I started to run. It was a decision to begin. I started running. It describes the action of running. Like. I like to swim. It can imply preference. I like swimming. It describes enjoyment of the activity. Practice time. Now that you know about infinitives and gerunds, let's practice. Fill in the blanks with either the infinitive or the gerund form of the verbs. I love parentheses dance parentheses at parties. She wants parentheses learn parentheses how to cook. He enjoys parentheses play parentheses video games. They decided parentheses go parentheses on a trip. I dislike parentheses wake parentheses up early. Answers. I love dancing at parties. She wants to learn how to cook. He enjoys playing video games. They decided to go on a trip. I dislike waking up early. Conclusion. Infinitives and gerunds are important parts of the English language. They help us express our thoughts and feelings more clearly. By understanding how to use them, you can improve your writing and speaking skills. Keep practicing, and soon you'll feel confident using both forms.
In today's episode, we will learn about helpful American English idioms via an educational article from Maestro Circe's website at www.americanenglishidioms.com. Time to kill. Have some fun with American English idioms. Idioms are expressions that have a figurative meaning different from the literal meaning of the words used. Idioms are important in language as they add color and depth to communication and help convey complex ideas in a concise manner. Using idioms in everyday conversations can help make language more engaging and expressive. Idioms are frequently used in literature and media to add depth and nuance to storytelling and communication. Idioms are expressions that have a figurative meaning different from the literal meaning of the words used. Idioms are important in language as they add color and depth to communication and help convey complex ideas in a concise manner. Common American English idioms include break a leg, hit the hay, and butter someone up. Using idioms in everyday conversations can help make language more engaging and expressive. Idioms are frequently used in literature and media to add depth and nuance to storytelling and communication. The importance of idioms in language. Idioms play a crucial role in language as they encapsulate cultural wisdom and shared experiences. They serve as linguistic shortcuts that convey complex meanings in a few words, making communication more efficient. For instance, when someone says they are under the weather, it quickly communicates that they are feeling ill without needing to elaborate on their symptoms. This efficiency is particularly valuable in fast-paced conversations where time is of the essence. Moreover, idioms contribute to the richness and diversity of a language. They often reflect the history and culture of a community, providing insights into societal values and norms. For example, the idiom, "the ball is in your court," implies that it is now someone else's responsibility to take action. This expression not only conveys a sense of accountability but also highlights the importance of decision-making in interpersonal relationships. By using idioms, speakers can connect with their audience on a deeper level, fostering a sense of belonging and shared understanding. Common American English idioms. American English is replete with idiomatic expressions that have become integral to everyday communication. One such idiom is break the ice, which refers to initiating conversation in a social setting to ease tension or awkwardness. This phrase likely originates from the practice of breaking ice on rivers to allow boats to pass through, symbolizing the removal of barriers in social interactions. Another widely used idiom is burning the midnight oil, which means working late into the night. This expression harkens back to a time when oil lamps were used for light, and staying up late required burning oil for illumination. Such idioms not only convey specific meanings but also evoke imagery that enhances understanding. Incorporating idioms into everyday conversations can enhance communication by making it more engaging and relatable. For instance, when discussing a challenging project at work, one might say, "It's going to be a tough nut to crack." This expression not only conveys the difficulty of the task but also adds a layer of personality to the conversation. Using idioms can help break down barriers between speakers, creating a more relaxed atmosphere where ideas can flow freely. However, it is essential to use idioms judiciously, as overusing them can lead to confusion or misinterpretation, especially among non-native speakers. For example, if someone unfamiliar with American English hears the phrase "let the cat out of the bag," they may struggle to understand its meaning without context. Therefore, it is crucial to gauge your audience's familiarity with idiomatic expressions and adjust your language accordingly. When used appropriately, idioms can serve as powerful tools for connection and expression. Break the ice. To initiate a conversation or social interaction, I tried to break the ice with my new colleagues by asking about their weekend plans. Hit the nail on the head. To describe exactly what is causing a situation or problem. She hit the nail on the head when she pointed out the main issue with the project. Cost an arm and a leg. To be very expensive, the new car cost an arm and a leg, but it's worth it. Under the weather. To feel unwell or sick. I'm feeling a bit under the weather today, so I might not be able to go out. What does the idiom time to kill mean? The idiom time to kill means having extra time to spend because there is nothing else to do. How is the idiom time to kill used in a sentence? An example of using the idiom time to kill in a sentence is, I arrived at the airport with plenty of time to kill before my flight. What does the idiom have, some, time to kill mean? The idiom have, some, time to kill means having a period of time available with nothing specific to do. Can you provide an example of using the idiom have some time to kill in a sentence? An example of using the idiom have some time to kill in a sentence is, I have some time to kill before the meeting, so I'll grab a coffee.
Greetings, everyone. Today we will focus on listening comprehension in English. We have a special treat for you. An author based in Scotland, Vladislav Bogorov, has allowed us to share a chapter of his book, When History Had Other Plans. Here is an extract from Chapter 2. This chapter is about slavery under socialism. We will attach a link in our podcast episode notes so you can access more information about his book. Okay, are you ready to listen? Let's begin.
I am Alison McKenzie, and my co-author is
Vladislav Bogorov.
And we have written a new book, When History Had Other Plans. It is the first book to explain the last 100 years as a series of plans that not only failed, but achieved the exact opposite of what they were supposed to. Vladislav was born under socialism in the People's Republic of Bulgaria. He is now a British citizen and lives in Scotland, where he eats haggis while wearing his kilt. And I, as you can tell from my lovely Scottish accent, I was born in Scotland. Also, I'm no stranger to writing. Over the years, I have written many shopping lists and lottery tickets. However, my knowledge of history was basic. I learned history from TV shows and Hollywood movies, such as the Indiana Jones movies. And it is this ignorance of history that enabled me to edit our book so that it may be enjoyed and understood by everyday people.
The following is an extract from chapter 2 of When History Had Other Plans. The stated goal of Karl Marx was to free the exploited. "Workers of the world, unite! You have nothing to lose but your chains," was one of his famous quotes. In accordance with this, we, those living in the Soviet Empire, were taught from an early age that we have been liberated from the exploiters. Socialism equated freedom. But what if the liberation that began in 1917 actually ended in slavery in the early 1930s? This startling fact has been acknowledged by many authors since 1948, when Dalin and Nikolaevsky published their extensive study of slavery in the USSR, which covers all aspects: how slaves were made to work, how the methods used affected mortality rates, what living conditions were, etc. A lot of data can also be found in the memoirs of those who survived the Soviet concentration camps, from Solzhenitsyn and Shalamov to hundreds of others. It is not surprising that those witnessing the transportation of prisoners to the concentration camps by barges compared it to that of slaves shipped across the Atlantic. In the West, slavery is associated with Hollywood props such as chains and images of black people lashed under the hot Caribbean sun, not white people worked to death in concentration camps in Siberia. But the very word slave comes from the word for Slav, because the Slavic people, all of them white, were enslaved by both Arabs and Western Europeans for centuries. As Professor Thomas Sowell observed, slavery has nothing to do with race or racism, because people of all skin colors have been enslaved or have enslaved others throughout history. However, there was a difference between the slavery under socialism and slavery in the Caribbean. The number of slaves under socialism massively outnumbered any other example throughout human history. The same goes for the number of deaths resulting from slavery in the USSR, as Professor Rummel has observed. In some 70 years, it likely chewed up almost 40 million lives, well over twice as many as probably died in some 400 years of the African slave trade, from capture to sale in an Arab, Oriental, or New World market. Incidentally, that is not counting the slaves in the National Socialist concentration camps, who were also white. The acquisition of slaves in the USSR was organized like any other economic activity in a socialist state. There was a quota for it. The government planned in advance the number of prisoners that would be needed for the next year and would place an advance order for the arrests with the People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs, NKVD. In most countries, the law determines the number of the people behind bars. If more activities are criminalized, more people will be jailed. It was just the opposite under socialism, where the number of those locked up determined the law. The law was changed so that a pre-planned number would be reached. New articles were enacted if the number of slaves in the concentration camps was not sufficient, so that more people could be sentenced to forced labor. The word sentence used here does not mean that it what it does in the West today. It was not the decision of a court of law, let alone of an independent court of law. The sentence could not be appealed and was not reached through a transparent procedure following any rules. Moreover, the camp administration could refuse to release prisoners who had served their term if it found that necessary for economic reasons. Finally, the administration could, at its own discretion and without a new charge, rearrest a freed prisoner just because he had already been sentenced once before. In short, the state was not constrained by law regarding who could be forced to work and for how long. The fact that slaves under socialism were public property had another consequence. Their mortality rate was higher than in countries where the slaves were private property, like, for example, the privately owned slaves in the USA during the 19th century. Statistically speaking, life expectancy was better even for inmates in National Socialist concentration camps. A private slave owner ensured that his property was maintained and used for as long as possible. The official who managed the slaves under socialism had no such incentive. They hadn't paid for them and would not lose their investment if the slaves died. They could afford to be callous. In the words of Naftali Frankel, one of the early ideologists of the Soviet concentration camps, "We have to squeeze everything from a prisoner in the first 3 months. We will not him later." It made sense that the concentration camp prisoners were forced to work without proper shoes, clothes or food in sub-zero temperatures. They had to survive with the clothes and the shoes they were arrested in. For the women, that all with often meant pushing wheelbarrows through deep snow in high heels. It is no wonder that few survived beyond the first few months. One additional reason for the disregard of the well-being of the slaves was their availability. It was much easier to arrest people locally than to carry them across the Atlantic Ocean. They had less than 4 million slaves in the southern United States. As was pointed out, the Soviets had way more. The popular assumption is that those sent to concentration camps were enemies of Stalin's regime. In other words, that they must have been rich in the past or must have told a political joke in the present. That was not necessarily so. For example, there was a campaign to catch those without passports in the big Soviet cities in the early 1930s. It was the peasants who had no passports, and they were fleeing from their villages in a desperate attempt to save their lives, as at this time the famine artificially created by the Soviets was underway. Apart from catching peasants, those who took part in these hunting parties, as they were called, sometimes caught people with passports in order to fulfill the quota. Enemies or not, the camps needed workers. Some of the secret police report from the 1930s frankly stated that the need for qualified personnel would be satisfied by arresting suitable, in terms of professional qualification, persons. In other words, the usefulness of one's professional qualifications was grounds for imprisonment. Lavrenti Beria, the head of the secret police, suggested that specialists working in the secret police research bureaus should be sentenced to lengthy terms of imprisonment in order to make them work harder by promising them a reduction of their prison terms. So their freedom had to be taken away in order to be offered back to them in exchange for work. That it was clear to the rulers that imprisonment was about economic results and not punishment was evident in what Stalin said too. In August 1938, as the penal terms of a generation of convicts drew to a close, he playfully asked the USSR Supreme Soviet whether such convicts should be released on time. He declared that, from the viewpoint of the state economy, it would be a bad idea to set them free, since the camps would lose their best workers.
American English learners and teachers now have access to the songs and music lyrics from Maestro Circe's first music album, The Immigrant Ballads, Volume 1, which can be found on Maestro Circe's website at www.maestrocerce.com. This music album is dedicated to immigrants in the United States of America and all over the world. You can also listen to the music on YouTube, as well as popular music streaming services, including Spotify, Apple Music, iTunes, Amazon, Pandora, and Deezer, to name a few. Try to sing along with the songs and their lyrics to increase American English pronunciation, public speaking comfort level, as well as listening and reading comprehension.
American English learners and teachers, have you visited Maestro Circe's website yet? How about our weekly newsletter for learning and teaching English? Don't forget to visit www.maestrocerce.com as well as www.cercea.com. Thank you for listening to our weekly podcast for American English learners. We hope you learned a lot today and invite you to revisit our podcast channel for additional educational episodes. We will share another educational podcast with you within a week. Enjoy your week ahead.